Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Shanitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Multiple Myeloma. And this is a part one of a two-part series, and today's program is actually going to focus on really progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma, which I know is a very important idea for many of you who want to know more about what is the progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and about 25 other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 793 participants. You come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Canada, China, India, Jamaica, Korea, Syria, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, and we really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, we'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you have received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about the topics that our speakers will be covering. And there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as resources for you, as free resources for you to get assistance and help. And there is, of course, an evaluation form. And I would ask each of you to please complete that evaluation form. We very much depend upon your feedback to really determine the topics of the workshops that we offer going forward. You are our very best advisors, really, about what the best programs that you need are. So this today's topic, progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma, is one that many of you have asked us to offer this topic, and so we very much rely on your feedback. So take a moment and please complete that evaluation form, and we would be extraordinarily grateful to you. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker is Dr. William Bensinger. And Dr. Bensinger is professor of medicine, University of Washington. He is also director, autologous stem cell transplant program, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Bensinger is going to provide an overview of multiple myeloma. He's going to discuss the current standard of care and new treatment options. He's going to also discuss clinical trials and how research contributes to treatment options. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Bensinger.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I'm going to start by trying to tell you what multiple myeloma is. It's a cancer of the bone marrow, specifically a cancer that involves a particular type of white blood cell called a plasma cell, and these are antibody-producing cells. This cell normally resides in the bone marrow and makes antibodies that help protect us from infection. These abnormal cells fill up the bone marrow in an uncontrolled manner and typically produce large amounts of protein called monoclonal proteins that appear in the blood or urine. As the marrow fills up with these cells, this causes other problems such as anemia, which is low red blood cells, kidney problems, and bone disease. The cause of myeloma is not known, but increasingly we've observed that genetic alterations in the plasma cells lead up and play an important role in the development of the disease. There's roughly 20,000 new cases per year in the United States. It's about 1% of all cancers in the U.S. and about 10% of blood cancers. Currently, there's about 55,000 people in the U.S. with myeloma, and the median age at diagnosis is between 68 and 70 years of age. This is important because many treatments, such as stem cell transplantation, are limited to patients who are less than 70 years of age and may not be available to older patients. The disease is treatable with several different types of chemotherapies, but is generally not thought to be curable with conventional chemotherapy. However, due to the development of stem cell transplant and the development of these new drugs, the survival has improved markedly over the last several years. Now, patients typically will have bone pain or fatigue because of the anemia, low blood cells. They may have weight loss, or they may have frequent infections, but as much as 20 to 25% of patients have very mild or no symptoms at diagnosis. Now, treatment is usually done to reduce symptoms, so to correct the anemia and improve the fatigue, to combat bone damage or osteoporosis, high calcium levels from rapid bone destruction, frequent infections, or patients that have kidney damage. But if patients have only very mild anemia or mild osteoporosis without actually bone destruction, they may not need immediate treatment. Now, the disease usually responds to combinations of drugs, usually two or sometimes three drugs. And with the newer drugs, we have response rates as high as 80 to 100%. And complete responses in the range of 20 to 40%, and I'll explain what a complete response means. Stem cell transplantation is an important component of therapy, and as I said, it's becoming easier and more successful at treatment, but disease eradication, actual cure, is still a fairly elusive goal. Now, when we measure treatment response, we refer to a remission, which means no signs of disease, or a complete remission, which means the monoclonal proteins have disappeared from the blood and urine, and we don't find excess numbers of plasma cells in the bone marrow. Patients may have lesser degrees, such as a partial response, which is only perhaps a 50% reduction in the monoclonal protein. Now, the drugs that we use to treat myeloma, steroids are a mainstay of treatment, drugs like prednisone or dexamethasone. We use alkylating compounds, alkylating agents such as cyclophosphamide or melphalan, or a newer drug called bendamustine. Anthracyclines are sometimes used, such as doxorubicin or a pegylated form of doxorubicin. But the two new classes of drugs that have dramatically changed how we treat myeloma are the immunomodulators, which include thalidomide and lenalidomide, and the proteasome inhibitors, of which bortezomib is the first in class. As far as treatment goes, patients generally have an initial treatment of some kind, 2 to 3 drugs, and if they're transplant eligible, they can be referred for transplant. Some patients and some doctors choose if a patient is responding very well to their initial treatment and say are in a remission, they may choose just to store stem cells and defer transplant to a later date. Maintenance therapy seems to be increasingly important at maintaining responses and remissions for patients. And then at some point when the disease returns and relapses, a stem cell transplant can be used for the first time or can be used a second time if the first transplant was successful. And, of course, there are many new drugs that have become available. So some of the combinations that are being looked at and studied are combinations of bortezomib, dexamethasone with either thalidomide or lenalidomide, bortezomib and dexamethasone alone, or lenalidomide and dexamethasone, or combinations of bortezomib and Doxil with or without dexamethasone. Cyclophosphamide, one of the alkylators, is also often combined with bortezomib and dex. Now, for non-transplant patients, melphalan and prednisone combinations with thalidomide or bortezomib are used, or lenalidomide-dexamethasone combinations can also be used. Now, as I mentioned, high-dose therapy and stem cell transplant is an important part of therapy because we generally get higher rates of complete remission than with conventional therapies, although this this statement is being challenged somewhat by the development of these newer drug combinations. But we see prolonged disease-free intervals, what we call progression-free survival is longer, and improvement in overall survival. And it is still considered a standard of care for most settings. It's generally well tolerated in patients up to the ages of 65 to 70. And sometimes a second transplant in sequence, what we call a tandem transplant, may be better than one. And there are trials that have looked at this and other trials that are ongoing. Now, sometimes transplants from donors are used, allogeneic transplants, but these have a higher toxicity and a higher rate of risk of dying. They also have problems of graft versus host disease, but they do provide some patients better anti-tumor effects, but they are still, I think, considered investigational and should not be done outside a clinical trial. Now, patients who are candidates for autologous transplant are generally have a good performance status with adequate organ function, although it is possible sometimes to do autologous transplants in patients who have complete renal failure, kidney failure, and need dialysis. Patients can be treated while their disease is responsive or even in a relapse setting. As I said, it's generally offered to patients under the age of 70 years, but sometimes we can offer it to older patients as long as they have good performance status. Now, patients who are candidates for auto transplant are generally, we try to avoid drugs such as melphalan or BCNU or extensive radiation to the pelvis because that may compromise the ability to collect stem cells. Now, what we've learned so far is that certain combinations appear to be better for rates of remission and progression-free survival. We've learned that a combination of bortezomib, thalidomide, and dexamethasone was superior to a two-drug regimen of just thalidomide and dexamethasone. We've learned that a combination of bortezomib and dexamethasone is better than the traditional regimens such as VAD, which was used 10 years ago. Substituting the V in VAD, which is vincristine, for bortezomib to produce a regimen referred to as PAD, we've learned that PAD is better than VAD. And we've also learned recently that using novel drug combinations for patients from a large Italian study that used lenalidomide and dexamethasone induction, and then patients were assigned to either high-dose melphalan and transplant or a combination of melphalan, prednisone, and lenalidomide, that the high-dose melphalan produced a better progression-free survival. Now, for transplant-ineligible patients, regimens such as melphalan, prednisone, bortezomib, or thalidomide appear to be better than melphalan, prednisone alone. And we know that low-dose dexamethasone, weekly dex, is better when used with lenalidomide than a more intensive four-day pulse of dexamethasone with lenalidomide. There are maintenance studies underway with lenalidomide suggesting that progression-free survival is greatly improved by using this drug. And one trial may show differences already in survival. We also know that bortezomib maintenance is better for progression-free survival if bortezomib is used as part of the induction regimen. So these are some of the things we're learning now about these combinations. Now, there are a number of promising new drugs that are under development. Carfilzomib is one. This is a second-generation proteasome inhibitor like bortezomib and is highly active. One of the nice things about carfilzomib, it doesn't seem to have caused very much neuropathy. And there is a third-generation immunomodulatory drug called pomalidomide, which seems to be active even in some patients who've failed lenalidomide, that looks quite active. Some other exciting drugs are an antibody, a monoclonal antibody called elotuzumab that targets the myeloma cell and looks very active when combined with drugs such as lenalidomide and dex. And there's a class of drugs called histone deacetylase inhibitors. One drug, which is called vorinostat, is also very active when combined with other drugs such as bortezomib and dexamethasone. So as far as how research contributes to treatment options, all of the new drugs that we have today are the results of clinical trials with patient participation. So we wouldn't have thalidomide, bortezomib, lenalidomide, pomidronate, or zoledronate if it weren't for these clinical trials and active participation of patients. And this will continue. The newer drugs, such as carfilzomib or pomalidomide or elotuzumab, will only be available if patients participate in clinical trials. And actually, this is a way for patients who need these newer drugs before they're available to gain access to them by enrolling in a clinical trial. And so I would encourage patients who are eligible to consider this as one of their treatment options. It's a way to get access to new drugs, and it is the way we're going to make progress in the treatment of this disease. And with that, I think I'll stop.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Bensinger, for an extraordinary, just an excellent presentation and really very informative. And I think people feel very much up to date with the newest treatments and all the progress that's occurred. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Nupur Rajay. Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Rajay is going to discuss practical tips for side effect and pain management, including neuropathy, reducing complications of bone disease, communicating with your healthcare team about your quality of life concerns, and physical activity concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Rajay.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. Dr. Bensinger has given us all an excellent overview of myeloma, and as you've just heard, the use of novel therapies has resulted in the transformation of myeloma into a chronic disease. And it is indeed an exciting time in research because of the availability of several new drugs, which he has already mentioned. In the next few minutes, I will focus on symptom and pain management and finally focus on quality of life issues pertaining to your myeloma. We're excited certainly about the six FDA-approved drug combinations, which Bill has already told you about. And as mentioned by him, the expedited approval of these drugs was largely because of your participation in clinical trials. In the past year, again, as Dr. Bensinger has mentioned, the focus has shifted to the combination of these drugs, and you'll be seeing 100% response rates, obviously with the goal of transforming chronicity into cure. We've seen excellent efficacy and tolerability with these combinations. And because of the rapid evolution in the available therapies, I would encourage all of you to seek out clinical trials and communicate with your healthcare providers and see what is available at your centers and determine if that would be appropriate for you. Again, because of the chronicity of the nature of the disease now, symptom control has obviously taken center stage. It is critically important that you engage with your care team and communicate your symptoms so that they will be able to help you most effectively. And your care team includes you, where you are the leader, and of course your doctors, your nurses, your nurse practitioners, the social workers, and all of the different avenues which we will mention towards the end. When thinking about symptoms, I focus on symptoms first related to the myeloma itself. Again, Dr. Bensinger has given you a nice overview of the disease symptoms, and he's talked to you about symptoms which may be related to bone disease or may result from the presence of protein in the blood or urine or from bone marrow infiltration of the plasma cells itself. Symptoms of bone pain and anemia remain the most common presenting features affecting more than 80% of patients with myeloma. Fatigue due to anemia is fairly common, and certain drugs like EPO or erythropoietin can help prevent anemia. obviously the treatment of the underlying anemia, its underlying myeloma itself, with the currently available treatment strategies which have just been mentioned, will obviously also help alleviate the anemia. Kidney dysfunction is not uncommon in patients with myeloma, and keeping up with adequate hydration is critically important and of benefit to all patients. Finally, patients with myeloma are at a risk of infections, and patients should take the onset of fever seriously and seek medical attention and seek appropriate immunizations when required. Although novel agents have been very effective and generally very well tolerated, it is important that you understand some of their side effects and again communicate these symptoms which are a consequence of the treatments itself so that appropriate measures can be taken to mitigate some of these symptoms. For example, agents like thalidomide and lenalidomide can predispose patients to thrombosis or risk of clotting. Depending on associated chemotherapy or other risk factors, patients are generally treated with either aspirin or blood thinners such as low molecular weight heparin or coumadin. Decrease in blood counts is common with lenalidomide, and therefore checking blood counts and adjusting lenalidomide doses are recommended if low counts develop. Bortezomib or Velcade can cause neuropathy, which results in pain and loss of sensation. Once this sets in, there are very specific guidelines in the management of neuropathy by dose-reducing the bortezomib. Symptomatic treatment with agents such as gabapentin and new ones such as Cymbalta and Lyrica are useful adjuncts to this setting. Supplements such as vitamin supplements, specifically vitamin B supplements, may be useful, and drugs such as L-carnitine or alpha-lipoic acid are also used as adjuncts for neuropathy. Neuropathy is also common with thalidomide and can rarely occur with lenalidomide, although very less frequently. Finally, keeping up with physical therapy and exercise help decrease problems not only associated with neuropathy, but also is of advantage to bone disease. As mentioned previously, symptoms of myeloma are largely related to anemia and bone disease. Targeting the underlying myeloma helps improve all of these. Treatment of bone disease is critically important in myeloma because if left untreated, patients with myeloma bone disease can result in fractures, pain, compression fractures of the vertebral body. Strategies to treat bone disease in myeloma include bisphosphonates, which include drugs like pomidronate or iridia or zoledronic acid, and these are recommended for every patient with bone disease. These bone-strengthening agents have proven in randomized trials to decrease the incidence of complications such as pain, fractures, need for radiation, etc. in patients with myeloma. Most recently, a large randomized trial in the United Kingdom has demonstrated a benefit in terms of even improving survival for myeloma patients when treated with zoledronic acid. A side effect which is noted with bisphosphonates and which is often talked about more is osteonecrosis of the jaw. This, with our understanding of osteonecrosis of the jaw and with our awareness of this complication, is in fact decreasing in incidence. There's about 3% of patients who end up with osteonecrosis of the jaw, and the key to remember with ONJ and bisphosphonates is make sure you continue with good dental and oral hygiene. Make sure you let your dentist know that you're on a bisphosphonate and avoid tooth extraction and invasive surgery to the mouth. For bone disease, we have other local measures which sometimes help with pain control as well as prevention of fractures, etc. And these include vertebral augmentation procedures such as vertebroplasties and kyphoplasties, which can be very useful adjuncts for pain. In certain situations, we do tend to use radiation, but most of us do like to use radiation infrequently as radiation therapy can affect bone marrow reserve and affect blood counts in patients. Sometimes surgical fixation for bone disease is the recommended option depending on the nature of bone disease. excitingly, we have several new drugs which we are evaluating in the treatment of bone disease as well. One such new drug is denosumab, or a RANK ligand inhibitor. This is a study which is going to start very soon in multiple myeloma. It has already been studied in other solid cancers with the inclusion of a few myeloma patients where it did demonstrate that it was just as good in reducing skeletal-related events or fractures when compared to zoledronic acid. There are other anabolic agents or bone-forming agents which are currently in preclinical evaluation, and we are very excited about these, and hopefully these will be used in the future, not just as single agents, but incorporated with the use of bisphosphonates in the future. Besides these, some of the normal agents which you're already used to, such as bortezomib, also have bone anabolic effects or bone strengthening effects and are very beneficial to people with myeloma-related bone disease. Additionally, drugs like thalidomide and lenalidomide also help with strengthening of the bones. Given the complexity of both the symptoms and the available therapies for myeloma, partnering with your healthcare team and communicating all of these symptoms and concerns will allow you and your team to help manage your myeloma in the best possible way. Participating in available clinical trials will help inform all of us and help improve outcomes for all patients now and in the future. With that, I'm going to stop here, Carolyn. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ajay, for an excellent, really, presentation and really so compassionate and lots of information for everybody, and particularly about managing side effects and pain and the communication with the healthcare team, which I know we'll talk more about during the Q&A. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Rick Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker, and he is a clinical social work supervisor here at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to address the free psychosocial support services accessible from Cancer Care and the importance of a support network. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. Benzinger and Rajay. As I said before the call, it's always a pleasure being on a call with them, and I myself always learn new information, very valuable to the treatment of multiple myeloma. I've been asked to talk about the importance of building networks to support your care and tell you how Cancer Care can help. And to reiterate what Dr. Rajay said, building relationships with all members of your healthcare team is important, especially with a chronic cancer like multiple myeloma. For many, it's helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. They are your medical network, and mutual respect can go a long way toward fostering a supportive medical network to get your questions answered quickly. At the same time, it is equally important to build a personal support network, which includes family and friends, as well as people from your community center, house of worship, or place of employment. For many patients, one of the hardest things to say is, "I need help." But for people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why with a chronic illness, building a support network is so important. And by reaching out to as many as possible, you can help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves. Accepting changes are normal during treatment contributes toward nurturing your body and spirit, but stressors can elicit feelings of sadness and frustration. What is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless and scared as well. And this is when it is helpful to seek help of a social worker or other professionals from organizations such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care has oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help. This might include education on improving communication with your healthcare team, or it can be creative ideas to keep your social networks informed through phone trees or other technologies, or possibly mind-body-spirit techniques to help calm the mind and relax the body. Along with education and resources, Cancer Care provides financial assistance. For multiple myeloma patients, this is through a special fund called the Door-to-Door Grant that helps with transportation to treatment and appointments. We also provide counseling with professional social workers, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online groups for patients and loved ones. Groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. And the best thing about this is all these services are free. To many, social networks, building relationships with your healthcare team and support groups go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE and speak to a social worker to explore how we can help. I wish you all the best. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for really so eloquently describing the services of Cancer Care and really letting everyone know what the services are and how important it is to have that support network. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to explain to everybody how to queue up and ask questions, and we'll start the questions.
Thanks.
And you bring all of our speakers on board as well, so we can all be here to answer the questions as well.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Henry F. Your question, please.
Yes, doctors, either one of you. It's kind of a strange question, but have you ever heard of quinine having an effect on multiple myeloma? I recently was taking tonic water to relieve leg cramps, and my monoclonal protein has been increasing very gradually, but the next time after I was tested after I've been drinking this tonic water, it actually decreased, and I'm on no other drugs. I'm recovering, I had a stem cell transplant about a year and a half ago.
Well, thank you for that question, Henry. Thank you. Dr. Bensinger, would you like to address that?
I have to say I've not heard of quinine having a direct anti-myeloma effect, so perhaps Dr. Raj knows something about it. I've not heard this.
No, I would agree with you, Bill. I haven't heard of quinine having an anti-myeloma effect. The good news, Henry, is your myeloma protein is coming down. You know, we like to use tonic water for the cramping, which oftentimes you end up getting with neuropathy. We don't like to prescribe the drug quinine because it has other side effects, and I think one of the biggest side effects which is of concern to us is the issues it can cause with thrombocytopenia or low platelet counts. So the amount of quinine which is in tonic water is just about enough to take care of your cramping, but I hadn't heard about this anti-myeloma effect, so this is something we might want to study, I guess.
And we can all say we heard it on this call. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. It's a great audience already. My goodness. Thank you for that question, Henry. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Allison S. Your question, please.
Yes, I understand, might even be recently, that one of the thought leaders, or perhaps more than one, in the treatment of myeloma has come out with questions regarding the benefit of stem cell transplant. Would you address this, please?
I'll try to address that. Yes, I think that what's happened is 10 years ago, when we didn't have availability of these new drugs, it was uncommon for patients to achieve remissions, what we call complete remissions, with conventional therapies. Stem cell transplant was the only treatment that could produce a complete remission at that time. And then studies were done that showed that if you got initial therapy and then went on to transplant, not only did you get better remissions, your disease stayed in remission longer, and survival was better. Now we have new drugs that can produce, in combinations, complete remissions in a substantial portion of patients, rivaling the rate of remissions we see with stem cell transplant. So some people are saying, well, if I can get a remission with conventional therapy, do I need to have a transplant at all? And there are some studies that are underway to address this question, but in truth, we don't know for sure. What we do know is that even with the novel combination therapies, patients who then go on to transplant actually increase the numbers that get complete remissions. So if you get, say, 30% remissions with some new drug combination and then go to transplant, that fraction of patients increases from 30% to 45 or 50%. So we know that transplant adds to this. We don't know the question compared to conventional therapy, if you just stayed on your regular therapy, if a transplant would be better. So it is a work in progress, but I think for most patients who are eligible, transplant still offers an important treatment option.
Thank you. Okay, our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Sharon G. Your question, please.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Sharon. Your question?
I have been taking the GammaGar liquid via infusion once a month, and I'm having trouble getting it approved by my insurance company through Accredo Medco. They're saying that it's not approved for multiple myeloma, even though I've talked with the Myeloma Foundation here in California, Dr. Dury. He recommended that I go on it because I get frequent infections, but we're just having – I don't know if this is a drug that you recommend that I take for a long period of time, because our doctor's office is just getting hit with, you know, we can't get it. It's just very difficult.
Well,
and I'm just wondering
question.
How long I should be taking. I've been taking it about a year.
Okay. Well, thank you for the question. I'm going to ask Dr. Rajay to answer the medical component of your question. And then in terms of the insurance part of it, I would definitely want you to talk specifically with our staff at Cancer Care for help with financial concerns you may have. But I'm going to have Dr. Rajay address your medical question around that. Dr. Rajay?
Sure. So, Sharon, as I'd mentioned, you know, infection obviously is a concern with myeloma patients because of the immunocompromised nature. You have a protein which is excessively produced, and the other immunoglobulins tend to be suppressed, making you more prone to infections. So, you know, IVIG or intravenous immunoglobulin, which you're referring to, has been used to try and revamp your immune system, so to speak, to give you back some of normal immunoglobulin. We typically routinely do not use IVIG, or it is not recommended in every patient. Having said that, when you have recurrent infections or if you have serious infections, which some people with myeloma do, serious pneumonias getting you into an ICU kind of a setting, those are the situations where we would absolutely use IVIG. In terms of how often one needs to use intravenous immunoglobulin, you know, if you typically we use it once a month because the turnaround time for these immunoglobulins is about 3 to 4 weeks. If your disease is in remission, though, you should need it less frequently, and you may not need it on a monthly basis. So obviously I don't know the details, but this is generally how we would approach the use of immunoglobulins in the context of myeloma. It is a supportive care strategy, and it should only be used if there is evidence of serious recurrent life-threatening infections. And again, the frequency can certainly be dropped if you're in remission from your myeloma.
And Sharon, I'm going to call you after the call to discuss your concerns. But Rick, do you want to just comment about just our financial help to people and just in terms of often insurance dilemmas that people have?
Thanks, Carolyn. Well, and it's not an easy question to answer in many ways because it really is a big issue for most, if not all, people. In fact, myself, in the last 2 years since the Great Recession, I've heard the term the insured poor, even with people with insurance when it comes to cancer who are struggling with a lot of issues there. At Cancer Care, we could definitely help you address some of that, perhaps give you some ideas about advocacy, as well as other organizations that might address that or help you address that through some legal supports, because even when it comes to insurance and such, although there are some federal guidelines, each state has its own insurance laws which supersede that. So essentially there are really 50 insurance laws across the United States. So it is specific then to California oftentimes that you'd need somebody who's aware of that and advocating for you. But cancer care could perhaps help. The door-to-door grant does offer some transportation assistance, which might free up some other funds toward other expenses that might not be covered under insurance plans. But there might be other organizations as well. The Leukemia Lymphoma Society, I'll just put that out there for people who might not know that they cover all blood cancers. And about a year ago, they do have a fund that helps with medical expenses toward multiple myeloma. So they, too, are a resource.
Thank you so much. So there are resources for all of you on the call, and so definitely take advantage of those. And you probably all have a Cancer Care 800 number, and we'll give it to you at the end of the program as well. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mary W. Your question, please.
My question regards Revlimid and anemia. I was on Revlimid for 27 months, and my hemoglobin stayed kind of stable. I went off it for 18 months. It was still stable, and now because of my serum-free light chains, I'm back on it. But my hemoglobin is dropping after two courses of Revlimid.
Thank you for that question, Mary. Dr. Roger, could you address that?
Sure. So it sounds like you tolerated Revlimid very well in the past, Mary, and having a harder time now. And, you know, this is just a reflection of how long you've been on a drug like Revlimid or lenalidomide. This, we know, is marrow-toxic. It does cause anemia. It does cause low blood counts, and it can also cause low platelet counts. In your case, it's more the anemia. Now, the one thing I will say is you've have been previously treated, and with previous treatment, your bone marrow reserve tends to be a little bit lower, so you're a little more sensitive than you were probably previously because of all of the therapy you've had before. The other thing you have to think about, and I mentioned this when I spoke as well, you know, anemia is one of the presenting features of myeloma as well. So it's unclear whether the anemia is all related necessarily to the lenalidomide or how much of the myeloma is contributing to it. So once the myeloma starts getting better, hopefully the anemia should also get better. And, you know, we've seen this in the past. Oftentimes when we are using drugs in the setting where the disease has come back, we do tend to have to use lower doses. So you may not be somebody who's going to tolerate the 25 milligrams at this point, but might need to be on a lower dose as long as it's helping with your light chains going down as well.
Our next question, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Janice W. Your question, please.
Yes. I have some concerns about the new recommendation for maintenance. I seem to have every side effect that is possible on chemotherapy. And my concerns about going on lenalidomide, I guess, are two or three. One is the bone marrow toxicity that was just discussed, and I'm a retired pediatrician. I'm very familiar with antibiotic resistance and wonder, is it possible that being on a medication for maintenance would lead to some resistance? And then I guess the third factor as far as quality of life is the tremendous expense. The only way I could really afford it would be to go with the generic on the internet, and I don't know if that's okay, if that's been evaluated and is safe and effective. So that's my package of concerns.
Excellent questions. I'm going to ask Dr. Bensinger to address your medical questions, and then we'll Rick and I will address your economic questions about the cost. Dr. Bensinger?
Yeah, I think you're correct. Lenalidomide, even at the low doses, is associated with side effects. There are more cytopenias, low white cells, occasionally low platelets, and there is a higher incidence of infection. In addition, some patients have side effects such as fatigue that even at low doses can become debilitating. And so quality of life, I think, is an important component of the equation about whether I should be on maintenance therapies or not. In addition, as you have asked, there's a theoretical question of development of drug resistance. And it is possible that by chronic treatment with low-dose lenalidomide, you may make your cells more resistant to some other therapy. Unfortunately, in the grand scheme of things, drug resistance is a fact of life in myeloma. That is what happens to the disease with sequential treatments, whether they're chronic or whether they're intermittent therapies. And so it's something that ultimately has to be dealt with for all patients. As far as the expense, I'll let Carolyn address that, but it is truly, it is quite expensive to stay on it long term.
Dr. Benzinger, in terms of the, I don't know if you can comment on this or not, but the concept of purchasing these online.
Well,
I wouldn't
recommend that. I think you don't know the source of these drugs. They might be perfectly good generics, but you simply don't know. And I simply wouldn't do that. I think it's a mistake. It may not be the drug you think it is at all, for that matter. So unless you have some independent way of verifying the authenticity of what you're buying, I wouldn't do it.
And thank you. That's important, I think, for everyone to hear that. And also, so in terms of just the cost of medication, you know, Cancer Care does offer assistance both in terms of the cost, but also in terms of just helping to find resources to help you with the cost or to manage that so you can get the treatments you need. And Rick had mentioned earlier the door-to-door program, which actually provides financial assistance with transportation for treatment. That I think does sometimes free up money. And Rick, do you want to comment any further just in terms of our financial assistance programs?
Well, and both in this question and Sharon's question earlier, I'd also just like to elaborate. There are some national organizations for people who do have insurance, and if there's a question whether or not your insurance might help with some of this and might need an advocate, there is an organization, I assume it might be in your handouts, called the Patient Advocate Foundation. They are in Virginia, and like us, they are a nonprofit organization. They focus on insurance and workplace issues, and they do have lawyers in every state who do offer pro bono service. Also, there are some clearinghouse numbers that can be given out that are connected to a lot of the pharmaceutical companies that do have low-cost drug assistance programs. And what I found over the years is for many people who are technologically savvy going online and looking at your state's bar association, some states do have lawyers who offer pro bono service for medical treatment. And a lot of times, many of these things can be addressed more effectively on a letterhead from a lawyer. So there are some potential resources to help with some of the costs, and there are some advocacy resources to help perhaps nudge your insurance carriers to include that or cover some of that. At the same time, I just want to validate that the costs of many of these drugs, and in my 14 years in oncology, continue to go up, and it is an ongoing struggle, as many of us see on a national stage. It doesn't answer your question, but just to let you know, you're not alone. It is a big struggle with a lot of these medications and how to get access to them.
And I think our staff here at Cancer Care know a lot of the resources that you can tap into. So I would say I would very much encourage you to not try to figure this out all by yourself, that you would certainly want to work with your healthcare team, the people who know you well, and then to access our staff here for referrals or for help with getting information about there are co-payment assistance programs. There are a lot of different programs out there that might be able to be of a help to you. And putting them all together, it might really make all the difference in the world.
And Carolyn, one last thing on this too, that many people are somewhat embarrassed, or they prefer not to mention to their doctor that they can't afford it, or the insurance company isn't covering it. And again, as Dr. Roget said, and I had mentioned, all healthcare teams and oncology working teams, and many times your healthcare team might be able to guide you to a resource as well. But you do have to let them know that you are struggling with the copayment.
I would agree with that completely because, you know, we have things like the Chronic Disease Fund, which we help a lot of our patients to get coverage, so a lot of our patients don't necessarily have co-payments with their lenalidomide. So we are all acutely aware of how expensive the drug is, and the more chronically we use it, the more we are burdening patients, as well as, you know, spending a lot of money. But there are resources, as Rick is pointing out, and involving us with that is also very helpful, because we can oftentimes point you in the right direction.
And I know Dr. Benson, before the call started, commented how important it was to actually let everyone, let your healthcare team know what your concerns are.
Very much so.
So, because otherwise they don't know what your concerns are, and they may, I think, as Dr. Roche has said, there may be some funds right in the institution that that can be tapped into, as well as all the national funds as well. Thank you. Excellent question. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jack M. Your question, please.
Yes. One's a comment to both doctors is that many of the people that I've met by being involved in support groups are well under the age of 68 to 70 at their diagnosis, some as young as their early 20s. So I'm interested in knowing how the scale of age has come down over the years, because literally I know no one who got it as old as 68. And secondly, could you comment on the use of curcumin as a synergistic add-on to therapies? I took it when I was taking Velcade in a second round after remission on thalidomide. And while we don't know if it worked or not, only after one round of Velcade, I went into strict remission and only required two rounds. So I'm interested in knowing what your thoughts of use of curcumin might be.
Okay, well, thank you. Dr. Bensinger, would you like to address this?
Well, you're quite correct. This disease can occur in patients as young as 20. The youngest patient I'm aware of who ever developed the disease was 18. Nevertheless, the median age is, in fact, 68 to 70. And so there are a large number of patients, in fact, half of the patients, who are over this age that get the disease. And I can say, having seen a great many patients, that we see certainly younger patients with the disease, but an equal number of older patients. With regard to curcumin, there is some interest in this. I believe there's actually a clinical trial going on looking at this drug as an adjunct to other therapies for multiple myeloma. But I can't tell you what the results of that are, whether it's shown activity in these trials. Perhaps Dr. Roche would have more information than I.
Dr. Roche?
So as far as the curcumin is concerned, you know, there is preclinical data to support its use as an anti-cancer drug. It's more an anti-inflammatory drug, so certainly there is some basis to using it. The clinical trial data is not quite out as yet, so that's something we would closely follow. The one thing I would say is, you know, when you use curcumin or et cetera in purified forms, you really need to get to very high dose levels to try to get to somewhat effective doses within the body. So you have to use lots and lots of grams worth of the curcumin to get to reasonable levels. So we just have to wait and see. As far as, again, age, you know, I'd just like to point one thing out. You know, you did mention that this was a support group where you were seeing younger patients. I do think you see a more skewed population in support groups, because these are the folks who can travel, come to these support group events. So you do have myeloma happening in the older patients. It's just not that they're not able to make it to these support groups.
And Carolyn, if I could focus on that and just build on what Dr. Roche said, I was going to mention that too to Jack, that I too have run many multiple myeloma telephone support groups. And do get an older population. I have dealt with people. The youngest I've dealt with was in the 20s, people in their 40s, definitely. But I think, as Dr. Roche said, if it's face-to-face groups, younger people tend to seek that out a little bit more. 68 to 70 is not that old, but you begin to get a little beyond that, and sometimes people in my phone groups are dealing with multiple health issues and are less likely to have the ability to go to face-to-face groups. So reaching out to Cancer Care, we periodically do run online groups and telephone support groups, And in many of my multiple myeloma telephone groups, I would say the average age has been in the 60s and 70s for the most part. So that might be more conducive to that population.
Excellent. Well, I actually want to thank our speakers. You've just been really amazing. It's been an extraordinary call, I have to say. And I also want to thank all of our participants who asked such really great questions, because your questions really helped everybody on the call. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we realize that you will have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And with that in mind, I do want to again reiterate for you all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. So although the program will end soon, this workshop will end soon, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those go on endlessly, and all those resources are there for you all the time. Cancer Care has a staff of 50 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance. Cancer Care also offers a co-payment assistance program. We also offer a chance to talk with someone, individual counseling on the telephone or online. We also have support groups. We have them on the telephone and online. And we also have, of course, these workshops, and we have many materials, pamphlets and brochures and fact sheets that you can access for information about just different types of cancer, as well as just information about dealing with treatment side effects. And as we mentioned earlier, we do have a very specialized door-to-door program, which does provide really generous financial assistance for transportation for treatment for anyone living with myeloma. So that's something that you should be aware of as a resource as well. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with multiple myeloma. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support and that we're here for you. And we're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And I also want to remind you there is a part two of this series. So on July 26th, we have part two, which is coping with the stress of caregiving when your loved one has multiple myeloma. So I know many of you have signed up for that program, but there is a part two for this program. We're very delighted to be able to offer you that program as well. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.